Incredible story up there at coasttocoastam.com, the search for Yetis and Bigfoot. Just go take a look at it. And we're going to come back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Ken Gerhard with us as we talk about mysterious cryptids right here on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Villagers in a Siberian region town in Russia are buzz over not only a sighting of the famed abominable snowman Yeti, but also tantalizing photographs of possible Yeti footprints as well. According to media reports out of the area, the prints were discovered by a fisherman when he was looking for earthworms and stumbled upon the massive impressions in the mud. Initially, they thought they were from humans, but a closer look, they realized, no, no, this is something else. The full story at coasttocoastam.com. Amazing. Ken Gerhard, of course, is widely recognized cryptozoologist, a field investigator for the Center of Fortean Zoology and the Gulf Coast Bigfoot Research Organization, as well as a fellow of the Pangea Institute and a consultant for a number of paranormal groups. He has searched for evidence of mysterious animals and the legendary beasts all around the world, including the Loch Ness Monster, Bigfoot, the Chupacabra, giant winged creatures, and even werewolves. Here's Ken, back on Coast to Coast, one of our favorites. Ken, it's always a pleasure to have you on the show.
Hello, George. As always, it's a distinct pleasure to speak with you, and perhaps no better time of year to discuss accounts of weird and monstrous creatures.
Oh, my gosh, they're everywhere. This story out of Siberia, I don't know if you've had time to look at it, Ken, but there might be something to this one.
Well, of course. No, I haven't actually, George. I hadn't caught that one. Bigfoot's been in the news quite a lot lately. Bigfoot and all his cousins around the world, if you will. Siberia, as you know, is a vast and fairly uninhabited wasteland, and it's really no surprise that there are reports from that area. Certainly the type of habitat that could support some type of mysterious hominoid.
Ken, what would you say right now seems to be the hottest crypto topic? Is it Bigfoot or is it something else?
Well, it's it probably continues to be Bigfoot. It's such an iconic figure, in pop culture, and of course the notion of something very similar to us, of course, a hominid, something that's presumably very sentient and intelligent, but also represents kind of our basal beginnings as humans, something human-like but not quite human.
You have investigated a number of creatures. Which is the one that really still baffles you the most?
Oh, gosh. So many to talk about. As you know, for a number of years, I've investigated reports of winged cryptids, and those include both the so-called Native American thunderbirds, which are described as these monstrous bird-like creatures, in addition to living pterosaurs or pterodactyls, kind of prehistoric-looking things, and also the Mothman and these weird flying humanoid creatures. It just baffles me that if these things are, in fact, flying around, based on the eyewitness descriptions, they're huge, and it seems like they should be seen a lot more than they are.
Let's talk about some of the creatures out there. And, of course, the Minnesota Iceman is one of those that is dear to your investigative heart. That was a very strange story that broke around the 60s and 70s. And apparently somebody sold it in 2013 on eBay, right? I think that was possibility?
It was actually purchased by a buddy of mine, a guy that owns, named Steve Boosty, owns a Museum of the Weird up in Austin, Texas. Like me, Steve saw the Minnesota Iceman when he was a young boy and it had quite a profound impact on him. So when he saw it go up on eBay, he basically went after it. And so I was one of the first researchers that had an opportunity to revisit the Minnesota Iceman when he obtained it in 2013. Now, I also saw it as a young boy back at the Minnesota State Fair in 1976, and I have to say that it was one of the seminal events that put me on the track of unknown creatures.
How much did Steve have to pay to purchase it on eBay?
Oh, my gosh, I don't think I'm at liberty to actually say, but it was a pretty penny. And it included the original display. For your listeners that aren't aware, the Minnesota Iceman is was described as kind of a hairy, Bigfoot-like creature that was frozen in a block of ice and displayed in this glass sarcophagus or coffin at different carnivals and state fairs in the late 60s. And some people that saw this thing thought it was real, flesh and blood, not some kind of carnival trick or hoax. And subsequently, two of the world's leading cryptozoologists came in and looked at it for 3 days. They couldn't take a sample because it was frozen in the ice and the owner wouldn't allow them to touch it. But by observing it and photographing it and measuring it, they came to the conclusion that the thing was real. And then there was kind of a big to-do when the FBI got involved and the Smithsonian, and the owner of this exhibit, fearing that he might be in trouble, allegedly made a switch and had a latex dummy put into its place. And the original Iceman, as far as most cryptozoologists are concerned, has disappeared forever. So what we're looking at now, the display that's in Austin, is more than likely a fabrication based on the original, but that begs the question, what happened to the original? Where did it go?
Now, the one that Steve got, even though it may be a model, was it still in ice?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was in ice, and it had been kept at, maintained in Minnesota by a collector who had obtained it from the owner's family once the owner had passed away. So it was the exhibit itself was literally on ice. It kind of vanished for a number of years. But it resurfaced, and it's a pretty fascinating story. It's just one of those frustrating mischances in the field of cryptozoology where we may have had a physical specimen of some type of unknown hominid like a Bigfoot, and who knows where it is now. It's vanished.
And this creature apparently, Ken, was shot in the head or something like that?
Yeah, that's true, and that was one of the really grisly aspects is if you looked at this thing through the ice, which was rather opaque, but you could kind of get a good sense of what this thing really looked like. It looked like it had been shot a couple of times. It had a bullet wound in its arm, which it was holding upright, and it also had a bullet wound in its head, in its skull, and displaced one of its eyes. And so it looked like, someone had actually shot this thing. Now, the owner of the Minnesota Iceman had several different stories. They were always changing as far as how he obtained this thing. First, it was floating in a block of ice in the Pacific Ocean, and it was found by Russian sealers, and then Chinese fishermen, and so on and so forth. And finally, ultimately, he claimed that he shot this thing himself in the woods of Minnesota. So I guess we'll never know.
We won't. Okay. Well, it's a great story, and it would sure be nice if the original showed up sometime, huh?
Oh, yeah. Again, this is one of those frustrating mischances. Now, there's an interesting tie-in here. There have been rumors for years that the actual owner of the Minnesota Iceman may have been none other than film screen legend Jimmy Stewart.
Well, really?
He was actually quite interested in things like the Yeti. He was friends with a gentleman named Tom Slick who mounted expeditions to search for the Yeti. And Jimmy Stewart has ambiguously been linked to the Minnesota Iceman. Perhaps he obtained it in China and smuggled it back in the United States. But again, there are just so many aspects to that particular mystery, so many interesting kind of sidebars.
There was always talk, too, that it might have been a Neanderthal, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was the conclusion of Bernard Heuvelmans. He's the father of cryptozoology, and he was one of the gentlemen that studied it in 68. Bernard Heuvelmans, an esteemed zoologist from the Belgian Royal Institute of Natural History, and his conclusion was that it was, in fact, a surviving Neanderthal man.
Ken Gerhard with us. We're going to talk about all kinds of creatures. Ken, we're in this era now of incredible technology. Everybody has a smartphone, almost everybody. They can take video pictures. We've got special cameras, we have heat sensor cameras, laser cameras, night vision cameras. What's the latest there? Are we finding anything yet?
Well, again, it's a very frustrating part of cryptozoology is we have not been able to come up with any real definitive empirical evidence in terms of, a body, DNA, those types of things. But you're right. There are literally, think about it, thousands of trail cameras that hunters and outdoorsmen have put up around, in different wooded areas around the U.S. and North America. Think about all the people walking around with cameras on their phones. And, all of the video evidence, alleged video evidence of Bigfoot and other cryptids is just very subjective and open to interpretation, basically inconclusive. Usually these things, they're in the distance, they're out of focus, they're standing behind a bush,
Yeah. So, just can't quite make it out.
Can't quite. And I get people send me videos all the time. There was one that was filmed in allegedly in Michigan at the beginning of the month from an eagle nest cam, a stationary camera placed over an eagle's nest. And then there was also one very recently from Indonesia of an alleged Bigfoot walking in front of a waterfall. But as usual, they're just very inconclusive.
I tell you what, probably one of the craziest things Ken, is people dressed up like Bigfoot walking around by roads and fields. They're going to get shot at, aren't they?
Oh yeah, I wouldn't advise it. In fact, tragically, I think there was a gentleman that was hit by a car in Montana a few years ago. He was dressed up in a ghillie suit and was trying to prank people by running out of the woods, and he actually lost his life. So I definitely wouldn't recommend that anybody dress up in a Bigfoot gorilla type costume, ghillie suit, or anything like that, because there are certainly people out there with guns that might try to collect the definitive proof.
Well, and I don't think they'd get convicted either. They could always say, this creature came at me. It scared the living daylights out of me. I shot it in self-defense to protect myself. I don't think any court would convict a guy like that,
Perhaps.
who really thinks it might have been a creature.
Absolutely.
Jeez, strange things. Well, I want to go through a number of creatures. It's Creature Night on Coast to Coast. Ken Gerhart with us, of course. He's got a number of books out, by the way, and they include Encounters with Flying Humanoids, Monsters of Texas, Big Bird, Modern Sightings of Flying Monsters. We'll talk about all these kinds of creatures. I love the Thunderbird stories, Ken. They are fascinating to me.
Yeah, Thunderbirds are a real passion and focus of my research, have been for many years, since I first interviewed an eyewitness back in the early 2000s. Native American Thunderbird legends, range across North America. They have a number of different names, of course. The Lakota refer to them as the Wakanyan. They're known as the Pamala in New England. But the descriptions are very same in Native legends in terms of these giant super eagles, enormous feathered birds with wingspans that can essentially block out the sun. The name Thunderbird, of course, a reference to the beating of their wings. But in modern times, we have a number of accounts and sightings from, particularly from specific areas in the United States, here in South Texas where I live, Illinois, and the area, of course, near Alton, Illinois, historically, and also north central Pennsylvania. And I continue to have people get in touch with me, George, that have claimed to have seen these things. I've interviewed many of them, and they come across as very credible, sane people who've simply seen of something that they can't explain. And many of them are also skilled observers in terms of hunters, outdoorsmen, ranchers, and people that are used to wildlife and birds, and they describe these things as much, much bigger.
In Alton, Illinois, along the shoreline of the Mississippi, up there on the rocks, they have a picture painted by Native Americans that did the Piesaw bird. And there's an incredible story behind that of this large bird that one of their tribesmen had to fight off to save his life and some of the tribe's people. It's an amazing story.
Piesaw, the bird that devours man, is one interpretation of that name. And in 1948, there was actually, in April of 1948, there were a rash of Thunderbird sightings over Alton, Illinois, and some of those surrounding areas.
Ken, are these birds sighted? Are they more like pterodactyls or are they feathered? What do people say?
Well, that's kind of the confusing part of the Thunderbird research, George, is that I get sightings of both. I get sightings of the giant feathered, clearly feathered big birds or thunderbirds, described as being, very consistently described as being about 5 feet tall with a wingspan about 15 to 20 feet across,
God.
dark, solid colored feathers, hooked beak, very much like a raptor, like an eagle or a vulture. And then other people describe these things as looking very prehistoric. And then they say that no, they don't have feathers. They actually have these leathery wings, the traditional pterodactyl features like the head crest, sometimes a long reptilian tail. And those accounts actually overlap. I get a lot of those accounts from the same types of areas. So it's very difficult to separate the wheat from the chaff. Are people, in fact, misidentifying what they're seeing? You can imagine their adrenaline's really pumping when they have these experiences, so maybe it's hard for them to recall all of the details. But whatever these things are, if they exist, they obviously are something that probably prehistoric in nature, something that lived thousands or millions of years ago and somehow survived into modern times.
Are you convinced that creature does exist?
I would say that I'm pretty convinced based on the eyewitnesses that I've interviewed. I'd say about 75%. Now, the problem, of course, is the lack of hard physical evidence, because
right.
if there were, in fact, giant birds or giant pterodactyls, you would expect to find perhaps giant feathers, giant nests, perhaps would have been discovered by now, eggshell fragments of a monstrous size. So, big living things obviously leave clues behind, so... and nothing like that has been reported yet. And unlike Bigfoot or Sasquatch, we don't even have any footprints, hair samples, or anything like that. And the photographic evidence, of course, is non-existent. So I'd say I'm only about 75% convinced on the Thunderbirds. But I got to tell you, again, George, when you interview these people, when you look them in the eye, they're very convincing.
Yes, they're serious. They're not faking it, are they?
No, not at all.
With these birds especially, there was a story I had heard, was it real or not, Ken, of the mother that saw her little boy being picked up by one of these birds and swiped at him with a broom and the bird dropped the kid?
Yeah, that's actually a very well-known account. In the middle of Illinois, a little town called Lawndale, Logan County, July 25th, 1977, a young boy named Marlon Lowe, 10-year-old boy, he only weighed about 65 pounds. He was about 4 feet tall. In front of several eyewitnesses, he was actually picked up by one of two very large birds that were flying overhead, and he was carried a distance of about 35 feet, about 2 feet off the ground, until he was able to struggle and kick and punch his way free. And this was, again, witnessed by his parents and some other adults that were also in the backyard. With hesitation, they actually went and reported to the police because they were concerned for other people's safety. And local wildlife officials quickly tried to write off the whole incident as a misidentification of turkey vultures, et cetera, et cetera. The problem being the turkey vultures do not have powerful enough talons to lift a 65-pound boy off the ground, nor do even the largest known eagles or birds of prey. So if, in fact, that did happen, then you would have to be talking about something completely unknown.
And what is the largest known bird now? Is it the condor?
Yeah, the Andean condor is the heaviest bird. It has a wingspan of about 11 feet across. I think the really large one can probably weigh about 50 pounds. A general rule, George, is that a large raptor or bird of prey can only pick up about half of its body weight. So if Marlon Lowe weighed 60 pounds and something picked him off the ground, then presumably you're talking about something, a bird that weighs about 120 pounds, which is pretty huge and heavy for any type of bird. But there were, in fact, birds that weighed that much. Back during the Miocene epoch, these were called pterotaurans, and there was one in South America that had a 24-foot wingspan, probably weighed about 150 pounds, stood about as tall as a man. So there is evidence in our fossil history that these big birds may, in fact, exist and may still be around.
Those are fascinating. We're going to come back in a moment with Ken Gerhardt. He's got his Facebook page linked up at coasttocoastam.com, but we're going to talk about werewolves, chupacabras, the Loch Ness Monster, and so many. How about, by the way, cat-sized spiders in the United States? How would you like to see one of those things on your bed when you wake up in the morning? Wow. We're going to come back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Ken's books are still available, by the way. We'll tell you how you can get them. They're just great crypto books. That'll be next on Coast to Coast AM. Need to email me? George@coasttocoastam.com. And welcome back to Coast, Ken Gerhardt with us. Ken, these creatures are so fascinating. I can't pick the one I really like the best. I mean, they're just all fantastic, aren't they?
Oh, yeah. I feel very blessed to have the opportunity to investigate a whole myriad of mysterious creatures. Some, to be honest with you, maybe a little bit more believable than others.
Sure.
Never a dull day.
Well, like the werewolves. It's easy to categorize werewolves as, a great legend, myth, old-time story, but there's got to be an heir to something. People are seeing something. What are you picking up these days with that?
Well, that's just the thing, George. This is just my belief, but I think behind every legend, every myth, there has to be some modicum, some tiny grain of truth. Now, the notion of a werewolf, and of course most people envision kind of the Hollywood version, which is a shape-shifting lycanthrope, kind of a wolfman type creature. But the truth is that you have widespread legends of werewolves all over the world, and they go by a variety of different names. And Eastern Europe, it's the Vokalak. In South America, the Lobison. In Louisiana, you have the Rougarou. So you have all of these legends of essentially what are described as wolf-like animals, but much larger than wolves, much more ferocious and vicious. And, even recently, we have a rash of sightings of strange wolf-like creatures in the Midwestern United States, and those are being referred to as the Dog Man, kind of an anglicized or Americanized version of Wolfman or werewolf. But what's really cool, George, is that I had the opportunity in 2009, I traveled to France and investigated a famous legendary creature known as the Beast of Gévaudan. And this particular animal, in the 1760s, went on a rampage throughout southern France and may have killed over 100 people. This is well documented. There are death certificates and a number of other documents from that time period that indicate this actually happened. This animal was described as larger, much larger than a wolf, with a long tail, kind of shaggy fur with a stripe down its back, and literally eviscerating villagers on a monumental scale. Now, most of the victims were isolated women and children who were out tending to herds of livestock in remote wooded areas. But this became such a problem that King Louis XV actually dispatched soldiers and professional wolf hunters to try to end this problem. And the killings went on for about 2 years until a gentleman named Jean Chastel finally killed a strange animal with a silver bullet, according to legend, which is where we may have derived that particular part of the werewolf legend. That creature, whatever it may have been, we still don't know for sure all these years later. For all intents and purposes, that was an actual werewolf.
Do these creatures walk upright at all, Ken, or are they on all fours?
Well, in the case of the Beast of Gévaudan, there are only a couple of accounts of it walking upright, in one case crossing a stream on its hind legs. But in recent years, the sightings that have surfaced in the Midwestern United States, and it's referred to, again, as the Dog Man, the Michigan Dog Man, the Beast of Bray Road in Wisconsin, and so forth, in those particular sightings, there have been many descriptions of these animals walking on their hind legs bipedally and completely upright. Now, Linda Godfrey, who's an expert on the subject, also informs me that there are sightings of these animals going down on all fours and also standing upright and walking on their hind legs as if they can do both.
Now, does anybody report these creatures attacking people?
They seem to be very aggressive in nature, but as far as I know, no one's actually been physically harmed. There have been several instances of them chasing people, attacking cars, scratching cars, feasting on roadkill, and so forth. So they seem to have a very menacing and malevolent nature. In my new book, I write about an incident that took place in Poland, and this was in the 1960s, where a woman was attacked by a werewolf-type creature referred to as a Wilkolak. And that, in fact, did accost her and physically attack her until her husband charged out of the house and rescued her by hitting it with a club or a stick. In South America, we have these creatures known as the Lobison, the wolf men. And researchers who I'm in contact with down there have sent me accounts where these creatures are evidently very aggressive and hostile and have chased and attacked people as well. Here in the United States, I'm not really familiar with any accounts of that nature, though, again, they have been described as chasing cars and chasing people through the woods and so forth.
What do we hear about the chupacabra?
Ah, yes, one of my favorites, the chupacabra. The chupacabra is, of course, an iconic monster that's kind of risen up in recent years. The physical descriptions vary, although we have reports from basically all of the Latin American countries, beginning in Puerto Rico in the 1990s, spreading into Mexico, Panama, Nicaragua, Chile, and so forth, and even here in the United States and Texas. There are a number of physical descriptions to the chupacabra. Some people say it's kind of a weird bipedal reptilian creature with alien, large almond-shaped alien eyes. Some people say it is a bat-type creature. And here in Texas, kind of a wolf-like creature. The common thread in all chupacabra accounts is the fact that this animal predates in a vampire-like fashion. That is, it comes in and drinks the blood of its victims, which are small farm animals like goats and chickens and so forth, not actually eating their flesh as you would expect from a typical predator, but just drinking their blood and leaving behind a telltale sign, which is typically two deep puncture wounds in the neck area. So,
and they're not particularly big creatures, are they?
Not necessarily. No, they're not. They're not described as being gigantic and massive. The Puerto Rican version, I think, is said to stand about 3 feet tall. You know, the creature here in Texas that's been referred to as a chupacabra, probably mistakenly, is more of like a coyote type of animal. With a strange skin condition or disease. In Chile, they've been described as looking kind of like winged dog-like animals or kangaroo-like animals with bat-like wings. One interesting case I investigated 2 years ago, I went down to Mexico. Down in south central Mexico, there were some really alarming livestock killings where ranchers were losing as many as 100 goats in one evening.
Oh my God!
To some unseen predator, and according to the reports, these goats were left essentially drained of their blood. Now I went down to investigate, and the photographs I saw, there actually was some blood present, but you know, you really got to wonder what type of animal, if any, is capable of killing up to 100 goats that are, you know, together in one pen in the course of one evening. And Mexico, as you know, traditionally has many sightings or reports of the so-called chupacabra.
And obviously, it was done quickly and quietly. You would think all those goats getting attacked, they'd make some noise. The farmers would hear that.
Yes, that's true. In one case, I visited a ranch where the man of the household was away, and the house was actually situated a couple of hundred yards away from the goat pen, and there was a lady home alone, and she didn't really hear anything. She, you know, when she went out the next morning to feed the goats, that's when she discovered the massacred goats in that particular pen. But what was really strange is there were, and I examined the location, there was really no place where a large animal could have entered that pen. There was, you know, these goats were fairly secure, protected from known predators like mountain lions, coyotes, and so forth. So the real mystery was how this unseen vampire-like killer actually got into this enclosure.
Well, with Ken Gerhardt, the cryptozoologist, and you have a Facebook account, Ken, do you not?
Yes. Ken Gerhardt, cryptozoologist, if anyone wants to get in touch with me.
Super, super. Let's move on to the Loch Ness Monster. What are we dealing with here? I've always thought it was a plesiosaur.
That is kind of the common theory, George. The common perception that all of us have of the Loch Ness Monster, if it exists, is a long-necked creature with a small head. And
little flippers.
And flippers and a large body, long tail. And that, of course, is a very close match to the plesiosaurs, as you mentioned. These, of course, were archaic marine saurians that lived. They were contemporary with the dinosaurs up until about 65 million years ago at the end of the Cretaceous period. The problem with that particular theory is that plesiosaurs, as reptiles, were presumably cold-blooded, so they would have not acclimated very well to the cold, frigid temperatures of Loch Ness, which is very far north. The other problem, of course, is that plesiosaurs were air breathers, as all reptiles are. So they would, you know, have to come to the surface to breathe on a fairly regular basis. So if you're trying to envision a small population of these surviving plesiosaurs in Loch Ness, why aren't they being seen more often? You have literally millions of tourists scouring the shores with binoculars and cameras on a daily basis. One of the more conservative theories that many of my colleagues endorse is the fact that the Loch Ness Monster may be a giant eel of some kind. There are some very large eels throughout the British Islands. Perhaps we're talking of an eel of a monstrous nature. But one theory that I explore in my new book is the possibility that the Loch Ness Monster, or Nessie, could be a giant amphibian. And this is not my idea. This is an idea that's been around since the early 1930s when Nessie was first reported. But when you consider the fact that amphibians, unlike reptiles, are more acclimated to cold water. For example, we have the giant salamanders of Japan and China that really prefer cold, running water. And in addition to that, amphibians, unlike reptiles, can actually they have what's called cutaneous respiration, meaning that they can exchange gases through their skin, or basically breathe through their skin, even when they're underwater. So, you know, theoretically, if you had some kind of enormous amphibian, like a giant salamander or something like that, it could essentially sit at the bottom of a lake, and it would not need to come to the surface very often, which would explain why they're not reported very often. And, you know, before your listeners roll their eyes at me, I have to point out that there were, in fact, huge amphibians that existed during the Carboniferous period about 300 million years ago. You had some really massive aquatic amphibians that were up to 15 feet in length. So the notion of a giant newt or salamander, something on that size and scale, is not totally impossible.
Well, that's true. Steve Walton believes that Nessie is an eel as well.
Yes. And that's, you know, that's a fair presumption too, although there are many accounts of Nessie swimming with its head above. And fish, as you know, are not capable of doing that. And, you know, the last thing, George, is we could be dealing with a case of composite identity, meaning that we've got a whole bunch of different things kind of being lumped together. There are occasionally visitors to Loch Ness in terms of seals and small whales and animals like that, that swim into the lake through a series of canals and rivers. So perhaps people are misidentifying those. Perhaps they're seeing large otters, perhaps giant eels, perhaps all of that is kind of being lumped together under the general heading of the Loch Ness Monster.
And, you know, are people still seeing these creatures today?
Well, you know, one of the really compelling parts of the Lake Monster mystery, not just Loch Ness, but Lake Monster mysteries, you have reports of similar creatures from lakes all over the world, from Canada to Lake Champlain in upstate
right.
New York to Scandinavia, Ireland, Russia, Japan, so forth. And these lakes are all very similar. They all lie within the latitude of 40 to 60 degrees north. They're all cold glacial lakes. And the descriptions are very similar. Basically, large undulating creatures that have very smooth skin, not scaly, very dark colored, and long necks and small heads poking out of the water. And these descriptions are also very similar to the accounts of sea serpents, the great sea serpents that were described by sailors for many centuries around the world. So as you know, George, I mean, 71% of the Earth's surface is covered by very deep water.
We literally
don't know anything about what could exist in those depths.
What were sailors looking at, Ken, when they thought they saw mermaids?
Mermaids, wow, yeah, that's definitely a bit of a head-scratcher, because you're talking about a biological impossibility, or an evolutionarily impossibility, in terms of combining the features of a humanoid with a fish or a dolphin or something that's completely aquatic. One of the conservative theories is that sailors were misidentifying known animals like manatees and dugongs and seals and so forth, but that doesn't necessarily jibe. Like our werewolves, I would say that there is a remote possibility that there is some shred of truth behind the mermaid legends, that perhaps there is some kind of aquatic animal that lives in the Earth's oceans that looks very similar to what people are describing, although I would rank that on the lower end of the scale in terms of probability. But legends of mermaids date back to the ancient Babylonians. Thousands of years ago, they worshipped this demigod named Oannes, which was described as a man-like form with also fish like features. And you also have modern accounts of mermaids, which is very surprising, and I list some of those in my new book, but there are accounts of mermaids as recently as 2011. A mermaid was allegedly sighted off the coast of Israel. So it is really hard to kind of wrap your head around. For my money, George, I kind of lump the mermaids in with things like the Mothman and the flying humanoids, that perhaps they are not truly flesh and blood creatures, but some type of spectral manifestation. You want to refer to it as interdimensional or extraterrestrial or demonic or something along those lines. It just doesn't make sense that something like that would have evolved in the Earth's oceans. But again, the Earth's oceans are very unexplored. Even the most conservative scientists will tell you that there's literally anything down there.
Ken's new book, A Menagerie of Mysterious Beasts, Encounters with Cryptid Creatures. They seem to be everywhere, though, Ken, don't they?
Yeah, they are. In fact, I think we discussed this last year when I came on, but I did a series for History Channel called Missing in Alaska.
Right.
And while we were up there, we investigated a mermaid-type creature known as the Qualu Pollock, which is very prevalent in Inuit mythology. And we actually found that there were some modern sightings of this mermaid-type creature off the coast of Alaska. And again, the descriptions date back. I think some famous explorers, Henry Hudson, for one, claimed that there was a mermaid sighting from that his particular craft when he was exploring northern Canada many years ago. So who knows? Maybe mermaids do exist, but I'm not going to put them on the higher end of the scale just because the physical characteristics defy all logic.
Some people think they could be that animal, the manatee.
Yeah, absolutely. Manatees and dugongs, granted they're not beautiful, long-haired creatures as many mermaids are, but they do have a very human-like quality, particularly when they come out of the water. Female dugongs and manatees, which are mammals, have visible breasts, and sometimes when they nurse their young, they actually hold their young against their breast in a very human-like way, kind of halfway up in the water. And so you can imagine that maybe if something like that were sighted by a sailor from a great distance...
That's right, they'd think that.
They may have misinterpreted what they were seeing.
We're going to come back in a moment, in the final hour to go. We'll take phone calls with Ken Gerhard, but we're going to be talking about dragons. What about a dinosaur in Texas? What about large spiders? Got to get to them. And little people, I mean really tiny little people. Next.